All right, so we are going to start tonight in chapter 13, and I think that what we'll do is, because we could move really fast through this material, or we could move really slowly. It'll kind of depend on how much you guys want to talk about it, because a lot of this, and so really, it's going to depend on you guys. We might get through a couple. I think what we'll do is we'll do it a couple verses at a time. We'll do verses 1 through 4, and we'll talk about it. And then we'll do 5. Yeah, if we get further than that, then we'll do maybe 11 through 17. Maybe. So we went last week, we were in chapter 12. And chapter 12 is kind of a watershed chapter in Revelation. If you guys remember, so just remembering the overall structure of Revelation. Chapters 1, chapter of Christ, the glorified Christ. Chapters 2 and 3 are about the history of the church. Chapter 4, John is transported into heaven, and he's told... He's given like this view of basically 5 through 11 are the first seven seals, and then the first six trumpets, and then the seventh trumpet is blown. At the end of chapter 11, we've had the seventh trumpet has been blown. And I believe it's us 3.5 years through the tribulation. The first 3.5 years are done. The last 3.5 years are yet to come. Israel has repented after the earthquake in the city of Jerusalem. Antichrist, they have now rejected Antichrist. But this is making it onto the internet now because I have to say this, and I'm too lazy to edit this out. So sit on your butt, drink your water. Okay, so, all right, so we get then to the end of chapter 11, and then we take a brief pause. And like I said, we get to this brief pause, and what happens is we get this description of the woman, the dragon, the child, and I think the end of chapter 12, or all of chapter 12, gets us to this point where we now have this pause. And so instead of moving in a straight line as we have, John goes back and he says that some child has been born. Now, I said last week that I think it makes the most child as the church and the dragon as Satan. And the dragon being Satan is pretty explicit, right? We saw that John goes out of his way to make sure we know who the dragon is. Okay, and then we get to the end, and what happens? So the woman gives birth, the dragon tries to kill the child. He's not able to. And then there's a war in heaven, and Michael, the archangel, and the other angels, they cast the dragon down to the earth, and he's not in heaven. And people are rejoicing because the accuser of the brethren is now on earth, but we hear that there's woe to the earth. Like, this is bad for the earth because now the dragon is down on earth, and he's furious because he knows that his time is short. He tries to kill the woman. Notice he doesn't try to kill the child again because the child has already been harpazo, has been raptured away. So the child isn't there. He can't kill the child, but who can he kill? He can kill the woman, and he also goes after, he makes war with the remaining of her seed. And so Israel right now, the remaining of her seed, I said last week that's a tough part for my interpretation, the remaining of her seed. But I thought about it more, and I'm like, no, I don't think it is, because the remaining of her seed would refer to those who are believers who are of the nation Israel. So it's not all believers, it's the believers of the nation Israel. Now, it just so happens that happens to constitute all the living Israelites, neither here nor there. But the beast ends, verse 18, we find out the dragon. So that's a really rapid recap of where we've been. Does anybody have any questions on any of the review material before we start? That's a good question. I don't really know the answer to that. I think that probably the best answer is that the mom, we're not supposed to take it literally. She didn't actually have more babies, but that's a really good question. I think that's good. Any other review questions we have before we jump into chapter 13? Okay, let's do verses 1 through 4. We'll see what we like, see what we don't like, see what we understand, and then we'll just keep going as we have time. So chapter 13, verse 1. And I saw, this is on my translation, and I saw a beast coming up out of the sea, having 10 horns and 7 heads, and upon his horns were 10 crowns, and upon his head like a leopard, and his feet like a bear, and his mouth like a lion's mouth. And the dragon gave him his ability and his throne and his great authority. And one out of his heads was like it had been slain into death, and the plague of his death was healed. And the whole earth marveled before the beast, and they worshipped the dragon, because he gave authority to the beast. And they worshipped the beast, saying, "Who is like the beast? Who is able to war with him?" Okay, now, once again, my translation, it's not very easy on the ears. It's good Greek and bad English. So you guys can read along in whatever translation you want, but let's just take a pause right now and say, what stands out to you guys about the why did the people worship the dragon instead of God? That's an excellent question. And I think if you can answer that question, you'll answer the entire question of the Bible, which is why to somebody other than God? Probably, if I had to give a really fast answer, it's because we love ourselves rather than God. Do you guys have any questions? What stands out to you guys? What are there things that like you say, oh man, this seems really familiar. I know I've seen this, or man, that yeah, So you point out quite rightly, I think, that is referring, keeping with Daniel. So there's a symbolism about it. I can't say every time, but uniformly, the general interpretation, at least among people, the beast coming out of this Christ, because he, now some people would say that he can still be Jewish, but he comes from among the Gentile nations. Maybe that could be. I don't know. But there's when we see the beast later, there's a beast that comes out of the earth, who's the false prophet, and that one comes out of the earth. And so most people have generally said that the beast coming out of the sea is a Gentile, the beast coming out of the earth is a Jew. And notice the beast that's the false prophet that comes out of the earth, what does he have? He has horns. He speaks like a lamb, but has horns like a goat. You know, so there's a lot of Hebrew imagery, a lot of that here. Now, if you'll notice in my translation, there's this really interesting, I think it's interesting, that the beast is coming. He has the 10 horns, the 7 heads. This is straight out of Daniel, as Deanne said. And his horns had 10 crowns. Again, straight out of Daniel. They represent rulership. And notice the 10. Remember the 10 toes? So this 10, don't miss it. Like, all of these things are fitting together. And then we see that upon his head were names of a blasphemy. Now, I don't know what your translations have, but they might have something like blasphemous names. They turn blasphemy into an adjective, which is, you can kind of do that. That's legitimate. But normally you would expect if it was blasphemous names, it would be names of blasphemies. So they would both be plural. So I chose to be really, really literal with this because I wonder, well, wait a second. Are all of the different names referring to the same blasphemy? That there aren't multiple blasphemies, that they're all referring to one blasphemy, which is that he is God, that he is the one who is greater than God. The idea that it is a system is pretty well accepted by a lot of people. I personally think that it's the beast as an individual who rules over a system, but I think there's certainly a system involved because later we find out, and in other places we see, that the 10 horns and stuff like that are referring to kings, that there are multiple rulers. So what happens then is there's this strange thing. So thank you for bringing that up. That's a really good point, and I probably wasn't going to mention that. But there's a really interesting thing where in the Bible, it's really hard to distinguish a ruler from their rule. Like a king in their kingdom are really difficult to separate and to parse out. And in fact, if you read, I don't know how many of you guys are familiar with King Lear. It's one of my favorite Shakespeare poems. But the characters of like the foreign kings are just called France. Like they're called by the name of the place that they rule. So the Duke of York is just called York. The Duke of Gloucester is just called Gloucester. The King of France is just called France. Now, that's not always done that way because Hamlet, when Hamlet comes back at the funeral of Ophelia, they say, you know, he has that famous line, "Behold, it is I, Hamlet the Dane." And Shakespeare capitalizes D because he means I am the Dane. I am the king. I am the ultimate Dane. I am the king of Danes. Well, anyways, so this idea of the system is, I think you're right, Deanne. I think that's a good point to add in, that it is referring to an entire kingdom. But we also have to remember that when we think in Old Testament terms, the king and the kingdom are inseparable. And we don't think that way because we live in a republic, a democratic republic. To us, the government is a system which is completely distinct from the persons because we don't think of power being invested in persons. They have power because they fill an office. It's the system that has power, not the person. In the Bible, it's not always that way. The kingdom has power because the king is invested personally with power. And so it's a very, You guys are all nodding your head, you get it, so I'm not going to belabor the point. But I think that's, yeah, that's an excellent. Other things that stand out to us here, things that you find, God is, if I said it, okay. Anything else that stands out to you guys? Okay, so if you look, if you guys keep thinking, if you see something that really draws out your attention you want to talk about, then let me know. But notice right here that he has his feet like a bear, his mouth like a lion, and this, again, straight out of Daniel, referring to Daniel, and the dragon gave him his ability. Now, we've got, first of all, giving him his ability. Now, that word is normally translated power, and where did we just see this? We just saw this at the hymn of praise at the end of chapter 12. You know, to him is all ability, all power. So we have this weird tension in the Bible, and this isn't just revelation. This is biblical theology. God has all power. All glory, power, and honor are his. And yet, Satan has power. How can Satan have power if God has all power? And then, when it says the dragon gave him his authority, does that mean that the dragon gave some of the authority the dragon had to the beast, or does it mean that the dragon provided the authority that the beast has, or does it just wrapping your heads around these crazy linguistic questions? It's not really important, but the important thing is there's this tension in the Bible, right? That God has power, and God doesn't just have some power. It's not as though power is divided up like a pie chart. And it's like, well, God has like 99%, 99.9999999999 extend the lines of power. But people have this much that isn't God's power. Well, it's not that way. It's not that God has most of the power and Satan has some, not much, but some, and then humans have a tiny bit of power that isn't God's. No, God has all power, and yet Satan also has power. And so if I'm asking you sincerely, I don't really know of a good way to come up with an analogy for that really makes sense, you know, other than to refer back to what Deanne said, which is kind of looking at it like a system. So if we go back to, for example, let's say we think about Joseph, right? So Joseph, when he comes to power in Egypt, who has all power? Pharaoh has all power in Egypt. But who actually had all power? Joseph was given all power. So wait a minute. So how can Pharaoh have all power and Joseph? Or were you going to say, Connie? Okay, yeah. And I guess my challenge is this, is I agree with you guys completely, but I'm struggling to think, well, how would you explain that to, you guys are old enough to understand it, but how would you explain that to a child? Like, and the reality is that we all... We also have the problem of explaining it to people who didn't grow up reading the Bible. I'm guessing you guys grew up going to church, you grew up reading the Bible, you grew up with concepts like this that help you understand it, and you guys have been going to church for a long, long time, so these are familiar concepts. But there are a lot of people who are new Christians, and that's not something that's self-evident to them. A lot of people think power is a zero-sum game, that power is a pie chart. Well, no, it's not a pie chart. Somehow Pharaoh can have all authority in Egypt and Joseph at the same time can have all authority in Egypt, but Pharaoh actually has power over Joseph. So I wish I could explain it better. I guess that's, if you guys can think of a good way to explain it, please let me know, because I would love to get a better way to explain this. But notice what happens here, and I want you, and I know you guys know this, and I know I've hammered on it before, so maybe I'm taking too much time here, but notice what the dragon has. The dragon has ability. The dragon has authority. The dragon has a throne. What does this look like? God, right? All of these descriptions are referred to for God and actually referred to for about God in just the previous chapter. Just in the last material we were reading in chapter 12, all of these things are talked about in reference to God. And so what we see, and you guys have probably heard this before, and so I won't belabor the point, but what happens with the dragon, the beast, and the false prophet, or the beast out of the sea and the beast out of the earth, or the dragon, the antichrist, and the false prophet, lots of different ways you can categorize it, is that is the unholy trinity. They mimic the holy trinity. Just like there's Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, here is dragon, beast out of the sea, beast out of the earth, or dragon, antichrist, false prophet. They mirror each other, and what Satan does is a cheap copy of what God does. It's a worse copy, it's a bad copy, but it's a copy. Satan is not, a lot of people have this idea that Satan wants to just go around and if he sees white, he wants to make black. That he hates God so much that he wants everything to be fire and brimstone and nasty and ugly. I don't think that's true. What Satan wants more than anything is to be God. He wants to be worshipped as God. The problem is that when you hate God utterly, then you don't leave yourself alone. So then we see what happens. So he's given all this stuff. The dragon gives him ability or power, a throne and authority. And one out of his heads, so this would actually refer back to what Deanne said. So at first you see the beast, and the beast is a person. We see in the Old Testament the beast is a person. But now, wait, one of his heads is an individual person. So the beast, again, if you're trying to nail this down, you know, like a butterfly, if you're trying to pin this thing down like a butterfly and label all the parts, you're going to get into problems because things can mean more than one thing. The beast refers to Antichrist, and it refers to the system, the world system that Antichrist creates. Because look at what we see. The dragon is giving him ability. So the text is telling us that it's both and. The text is telling us that, yes, it's a system because only one of his horns is an individual person. But the text is referring to the beast as an individual person. And so, again, you guys get it, so I won't belabor the point. But one of the heads was like it had been slain to death. Now, it doesn't say that it was slain to death. So this is an area where people disagree. They say, well, was Antichrist really slain to death, or did he just appear to be? Well, I don't know. Now, here's a bad argument. So some people will tell you that Antichrist couldn't actually be put to death because Satan can't create life, that Satan can't give life. He can only create death, and therefore the dragon would not have been able to raise the dead, and therefore the Antichrist couldn't have actually been killed. Okay, that's a somewhat reasonable argument, but let's go back to the plagues of Egypt. Using their magical arts, what did they do? The Egyptian magicians created life, didn't they? They created frogs, created gnats, created flies. They created a bunch of stuff. So they created life. And so this idea that only God in this world can create life, I don't know that holds. I don't know that argument holds water. Now, again, the text doesn't tell us that he actually died. It said that it was like he was slain into death. Maybe that just means it appeared that way. But he was healed, so Satan was able to heal, so at least Satan can restore cellular. And so the whole earth marveled before the beast. Notice that word marveled. That is a regular word that's referred to about Jesus in the Gospels. What do people do? The crowd's really common New Testament word for people seeing a miracle and being amazed. And they marveled, and what did they do? They worship the dragon. Now, will the people worship God? No. But what do? They worship the dragon. Why do they worship the dragon? Because he was given authority. They worship the dragon because he gave authority to the beast, and they worship the beast, saying, who is like the beast and who is able to war with him? So, why do they worship? So let's actually, sometimes in John, let me just pause and say this. Sometimes when you're reading John, it actually helps to go to the end and work your way backwards verse by verse. If you've never noticed that, when you get a really tricky passage in John, just go to the end and work your way backwards, and sometimes it makes a lot of sense. They thought differently than we did. So, the people say, who is like the beast and who is able to war with him? Now, first of all, that phrase, who is like, incidentally, who is like the beast, the who is like part, is exactly Michael the archangel that we just saw in chapter 12. Michael is Mikael. Mikael. Mi means who, ka is like, and then El is God. Who is like God? Mikael. This is who is like the. Could that be an accident? Sure, it could be an accident. It could be, but I don't think it is. I think this is deliberate wordplay to draw us to what we're supposed to look at. But what they say, who is like the beast and who is able to war with him? Now, why do they say who is able to war with him? Because he looked like he had been slain to death, but he wasn't. No one can make war against the beast because even if you kill the beast, he comes back to life. It's a resurrection. The people worship who was resurrected, who was raised. They worship the beast because the beast is like Jesus. Why don't they just worship Jesus? Why don't they just worship the real God? But then what do? They worship the dragon because the dragon gave authority to the beast. Why don't we worship God? Why don't they worship God? Why don't they worship Jesus? Jesus rose from the dead. Jesus is invincible. And then why don't they worship God the Father? Because God the Father raised him from the dead, and God the Father is going to give all authority and power. I'm not going to hammer you guys with this, but you guys see, right, how what this is just a fun house. It's a mockery of the Holy Trinity. You guys see it. I can tell you guys get it. But let's move on to, do you guys have anything else to say? Anything that you think is really interesting before we move on to verses 5? So I want to make sure people listening at home can hear that. why does God allow this when he has the power to stop it? Yeah, that is that a fair version? I have some kind of long philosophical answers. Do you have any? Does anybody have any thoughts why God allows it? Doesn't just have to be. Yeah, God's. One of the C.S. Lewis. I have it in my study, but C.S. What the question you asked, Connie, is a really good one, and it's an important question. And a lot of Christians just try to brush it off as though it's not an important question. It is. It's an important question. And the reality is we don't have a great answer to it. Now, I think we have better answers than other people do. We don't have a perfect answer to it. I think Lewis's point, if I'm fairly representing him, is that God wants people who love him freely. And for God to create people who love him freely and of their own free will, people have to have the ability to reject him. They have to be able to not. Thank you for that demonstration of robots. So, but if people aren't going to be robots, then they have to be free to do bad. And if they're free to do bad, how much freedom do you give them? Do you give them freedom to be just a little bit bad? And then so, and Lewis isn't crazy here. All Christians agree to some degree with that statement, that if people are going to be free, they have to be free to do evil. Now, do I think true freedom is the freedom to do evil? No, true freedom, true liberty, is the freedom to please God, to do what is right and what is good. But you can't say that you have to have the option available. And so, why does God allow it though? Why did God look at what? That's awful. That's terrible. And honestly, like I don't want to sound like an apologist for the Russians, because those soldiers have a choice, but a lot of them aren't given much of a choice. You know, they joined the army, and you know, for a long time, Soviet soldiers didn't have a chance. And the Russian army can be brutal. I mean, there are some horrible abuses that happen there that have been well documented. And so I feel bad for the Russian soldiers. And in fact, if you look, there are plenty of videos out there of capture, because most of them know that if they had a choice, most of those Russian soldiers wouldn't be there. Some of them would, yeah, certainly. But most of them wouldn't. Do they have the freedom to reject serving? They do. But historically, most people don't take that choice. The Brethren Church would be an example of people who refuse to fight, even for a war. But I wish I had a better answer for you. I think that if you come down to whatever the answer is, I don't have an answer, but whatever the answer is, it has people need to see how a lot of you guys have all met people, right, who they had to hit rock bottom before they were able to turn to God. I was that way. You know, now everybody's rock bottom is not the same. Some people's rock bottom is, you know, they show up late for work one day and they realize they're a tragic sinner. You know, for other people, it's pretty extreme. But people have to, God allows evil in the world because of that. The end. Yeah, you're right. That was. And I, how, I don't know how firm I want to be on this, but we're not the only creatures God has made. God has also created an angelic realm that is vastly superior in intellect and power to us. And part of what's going on is what's happening with Satan, his angels, and God and his angels. We're part of something much bigger than ourselves, and we're not given the full picture. And so maybe if we had some more people, I don't know. Any other questions? Okay, so I'll start reading in verse 5. And was given to him, that is the beast, a mouth to speak great blasphemies, to speak great and blasphemous things, and was given to him authority to make these things, to make I just have to interrupt myself here. He was making the blasphemies. This is really complicated Greek. It doesn't make good sense in English. You got to kind of fill in the blanks here. So he's saying the blasphemous things, and he has the ability to do these blasphemous things for 42 months. Okay, 42 months. And his mouth was opening into blasphemies to blaspheme God, his name, and his tent, and the ones tenting in the heaven, and was given to him to make a war with the holies, that is, the holies or the saints or the believers, and to conquer them, and was given to him authority upon every tribe and people and tongue and nation. And all the ones dwelling upon the earth worshipped him, which his name is not written in the book of life, and the Lamb, the one slain from the foundation of the world. Okay. Let's just pause right here. That is terrible English. Okay, that is the flaw of doing a really literal translation, because a really literal translation helps you really see what John is doing with wordplay in Greek, and it doesn't really help you understand what's going on. So let me read this out of the NIV. The beast was given a mouth to utter proud words and blasphemies and to exercise his authority for 42 months. Ah, that's already better, isn't it? Okay, he opened his mouth to blaspheme God and to slander his name and his dwelling place and those who live in heaven. And was given, and he was given power to make war against the saints and to conquer them. And he was given authority over every tribe, people, language, and nation. All the inhabitants of the earth will worship the beast, all whose names have not been written in the book of life belonging to the Lamb that was slain from the creation of the world. Okay, so just pause right there. The NIV, I think, does a really good job of clarifying what this means. What stands out to you guys? What do you guys think is interesting? It was, though, for some people, right? Like, it was for the Israelites, because the Israelites saw the abomination of desolation spoken of in the holy place, spoken of by Daniel, and then they recognized it and they turned. So you're right, it's not true that nobody did, but why didn't most people? And I think the answer is that people are actively engaged. They know that this is Satan. I think Satan has convinced the world that they can defeat God. If you guys have ever read, how many of you guys have seen the Lord of the Rings movies? Have you guys seen the Lord of the Rings or the Hobbit? Okay, so there's a book by J.R.R. Tolkien, the guy who wrote, or Tolkien as I normally pronounce his name. So Tolkien wrote a book called The Silmarillion, and The Silmarillion is kind of the prequel to the Lord of the Rings. It's talking about the creation of Middle-earth before everything. And what happens in that is the Satan character convinces them that they can defeat. It's not God per se, but they can defeat these supernatural beings that are vastly greater than them. And he brings about their ruin by convincing them to go to war against these beings that are vastly more powerful than them. Obviously, that's not the Bible, but that's one guy and his interpretation of what's happening. But I think Tolkien is pointing to something true, which is, and I know we've talked about this before, I don't remember when, I think people know. They know that it's the Lamb. They know that it's God, and they're in rebellion. They're in anger against God, and somehow I think it's conscious at this point. Now, it could be that I'm wrong. Like you said, it could just be insane amounts of ignorance and blindness. Could be, but I'm willing to say that people know that it's God, and they act. Like I said, it's what you're talking about is one of those really great theological questions of, like, why would people knowingly do something stupid? Well, people do. Other stuff that stands out to us, so... Oh, go ahead. That's an excellent point. I wasn't even thinking about bringing that up. I may have seen that at one point in my life, but no, that is a great point. Thank you. This is the one slain from the foundation of the world. Not the one slain here just recently, but he was slain from the foundation of the world. He is the one who was slain. Now, yeah, that verse right there, that would probably take, that last little part, slain from the foundation of the world, I'm not going to go into it because it is... It's just not worth getting into, but that is a little statement that is freighted with tons of meaning, tons of interpretation, and it's, whew, that's really hard. That's really hard to make sense of, and there's a lot of theologies. A lot of people's theologies hang on this, and I'm not exaggerating. There are a lot of people who put a lot of stock in this verse, and I'm like, that is not a great verse it's beautiful, it's poetic, but it's not a great verse because it's so unclear what it's actually referring to. Because the world in John, so when it says, actually, I'll say just this. So he was the Lamb slain from the foundation of the world. In John, and specifically in the book of Revelation, the word world, cosmos, does not refer to that. It refers generally, cosmos, in Revelation, cosmos refers to a system in rebellion against God. So to make sense of this, you got to make sense of what John means by this. So when John says he was slain from the foundation of the world, there's a lot of possible interpretations of that. Does it mean temporally? Well, maybe, but it doesn't have to mean that. It could mean that he was slain because of what happened, but because of the foundation of the world system, because of the foundation of the system of rebellion against God, he was slain because of that. That's probably not the best explanation of that, but it's one of many possibilities. So, great verse, beautiful, poetic. Don't hang any theology on it because it's very unclear. But your point is well taken, though. This lamb has a book of life. The other lamb will not let you buy or sell without having his number tattooed on your head or your hand. But this one is also writing down names. This lamb, the good lamb, he's writing down names, and his names will also prevent you from doing things. Because if your name isn't written in the Lamb's Book of Life, you will not enter the kingdom of God. So both of them are Christ figures. Both of them have been slain. Both of them have been risen. Both of them are keeping track. But one of them can only keep track in this world. And more to your point, notice what's happened. He's given authority over every tribe, people, tongue, and nation. Where have we? Obviously, we've seen this to refer to Jesus. The people worship him. And notice, John is really clear here. I want to make you see this because it really stands out. He makes war with the saints. He makes war with the saints. Notice he doesn't say the church. John has used the word church before. He doesn't say the word church. He says the saints or the holy ones. And he conquers them. Now, wait a second. I thought that the church was going to conquer. So there's this interesting play on words here. And I'll be honest, I don't know exactly what to do with that. If you guys have any thoughts, I'd love to hear them. And he conquers them. He overcomes them. And he has authority over every tribe, people, tongue, and nation, just like Jesus does. And all the ones dwelling on earth worshiped him. Okay, so now it makes you think he's totally defeated all the saints. All the saints are dead. There's only all these people who worship him. Nope, not true. Why? Because he qualifies it. Everyone whose name is not written in the book of life, in the Lamb's book of life. So there are saints in the world. And then he makes war against the saints, but they don't all die because some of them live, because everybody's worshiping Satan and the beast except for. Now, why am I making a big deal of this? Well, because it's important to recognize that God always has a remnant. God always has a remnant. That there are always people who still love and serve God in the world, or only for a small time. For the rapture, they'll be taken out, but God always leaves a remnant. There are believers here in this world, even now, as dark as things get, it's there. Now, it is interesting. So we talked about it a little bit before, but the Romans, does anybody know where the hope in some farmers? Okay, so in ancient Rome, they had a couple different winnowing practices. And they would, you know, there was, in the ancient world, they had the normal winnowing where people would have flails and they would hit things with either sticks like batons to break the seed kernels off, or they would have or they would use flails in the medieval period. And then what they would do is when they wanted to winnow, they would, you know, toss it up. They have these special winnowing baskets. I don't know if you guys have ever seen them. They're really cool. Have you guys seen a winnowing basket? You seen them on TV? Okay. Yeah, okay, so if you haven't seen a winnowing basket, they're pretty big, and they're these wicker baskets. They've got to be light, and they've got, and they're wicker, and they have these really tiny little cracks in them, and what people do is they kind of swirl them around, and they toss it up in the air. These people, it's amazing to watch these women do it, but they throw it up in the air, and the wind knocks the chaff off of it, and it falls down, and they catch it, and the violence of landing back down helps to break a little bit more of the shell of the hull or the husk or the chaff off, and then they toss it up again, and they keep tossing it until most or all of the chaff is off. So first there's the flailing process, and that gets some of it off. Then there's the winnowing process, and some of that gets some more of the chaff off until it's about ready. In the Roman world, there were some things that it didn't work for. There are some grains. Farmers, help me out here. There are some grains that you can't just winnow by air. You have to grunt, you have to do some physical force. The Romans called it a tribulum. So we get this word tribulation from the Roman tribulum. And sometimes it's called a threshing sledge, I think is like the old word for it. And it was a heavy weighted sled, and it was literally weighted, and it had all these little hooks on it. And it, you would run it over, you would put the grain down on like a grain floor, like a threshing floor. That something smooth enough that you could sweep, and then you would drag this threshing sledge over, and the weight, and then the little hooks would break up all of the grain to get rid of the chaff. People have pointed out, I think it was Perry Stone that I originally heard this from, but people pointed out that's kind of what's happening here in the Great Tribulation, is that there's still good grain here in this world. There's still something that God can get out. There's still saints that God can convert, but it's going to take an awful lot of violence to get it out. I mean, you compare taking some, you know, a handful of grain, throwing it up in the air, and catching it. That's not a lot, right? But compare that to laying it out on the floor and crushing it with this threshing sledge. It's quite a bit different. Anyways, we see here a lot of really cool things. Again, the comparisons with Jesus stand out. I think very obviously that what he... verse 9, just really quickly. If anyone has an ear here... Now, wait a second. We just saw the conquering, right? We just saw that he's going to conquer the saints. And then what did we see in all those conquering things? If anyone has an ear to hear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches, to him who overcomes. We see this play on it. Why? Because everything this chapter is trying to do is show us how what Satan has is an imitation church. He's creating an imitation church with an imitation Christ and an imitation Holy Spirit, and everything is a mockery. Everything. Does that make sense? Do you guys see what I'm saying? Okay, good. All right, so I'll shut up. Okay, here is the patience and the faith of the holies, or I think the NIV and other translations will say something like, this requires the patience of the saints, which I think is probably a pretty good translation. Verses 11 through 13, we'll cover this paragraph real quickly. And I saw another beast come up out of the earth, and he had two horns like a lamb, and he spoke like a dragon. Okay, so I misquoted that earlier. And he made all the authority of the first beast on his behalf, and he made the earth and the ones dwelling in it so that they will worship the first beast whose plague of his death was healed. Oh, wait a second. Now we get some clarity. It wasn't just like he was dead. It was that he was dead. Okay. And he made a great sign so that fire should come down out of heaven into the earth before men, and he should deceive the ones dwelling upon the earth through the signs which he gave to him to make before the beast, saying to the ones dwelling upon the earth, make an image to the beast which had the plague of the sword and lived. Okay, again, terrible English. My translation here, it's really hard to make sense of what's going on, but I'll give you the NIV real quick. Then I saw another beast coming up out of the earth. He had two horns like a lamb, but he spoke like a dragon. He exercised all the authority of the first beast on his behalf, and he made the earth and its inhabitants worship the first beast whose fatal wound had been healed. And he performed great and miraculous signs, even causing fire to come down from heaven to earth in full view of men. Because of the signs he was given power to do on behalf of the first beast, he deceived the inhabitants of the earth. He ordered them to set up an image in honor of the beast who was wounded by the sword and yet lived. Okay, so what do we see that stands out? What stands out to you? That is, you know what? People criticize it, but I love taking low-hanging fruit. You know, a lot of times it's the obvious stuff we think everybody sees where there's a lot of good work to be done. Yes, there's a second beast. There's a second beast, and he's doing stuff. And this second beast comes up out of the earth. So he's another beast. It's not just a different beast. He's another beast. And I believe, I'd have to check, I closed up my Greek text, but the word another here refers to another of the same kind. Now, I'd have to check, but I believe that's accurate. There are a couple different words for other in Greek. But he's another beast of the same kind. He comes up out of the earth, and he had two horns like a lamb. Well, who does that sound like? Jesus. But he spoke like a dragon. Who does that sound like? Satan. So again, he's like Jesus. He's like a lamb. He seems harmless. Oh, wait, except he has the voice of a dragon, right? And again, that reminds us of what? Paul warns us that Satan masquerades as an angel of light. You know, Satan wants you to think that everything's good. All right, so that stands out. Anything else stand out? Did fire Elijah? Do you remember where it was? Yeah, but do you remember the actual location, Elijah? It was on Mount Carmel. And on Mount Carmel, he did this miracle. Now, do you remember what the purpose of the miracle was? I think it's 1 Kings 7. Yep, there you go. That's the key. It was a contest between Baal and Yahweh. Because Elijah says, he asks the people, he says, how long will you waver between two opinions? If Baal is God, worship him. If Yahweh is God, worship him. And the people said, amen. Like, the people had no problem with it. When Elijah comes up and says this, the people say, you know what? You make perfect sense. Because Baal has not been able to provide rain. The people are starting to question whether Jezebel and Ahab are all that smart. Because they're saying Baal is a rain god. Baal is a storm god. He's supposed to provide rain. But Elijah's walking around saying, no, Yahweh says it's not going to rain until I say so, and he hasn't told me to say so. And there was a drought, and so people are wavering between two opinions. And what do? He calls down fire from heaven, and what does the fire from heaven demonstrate? That the one Elijah is preaching about is God. When he's doing this, when the false prophet does this, he is doing the exact same thing. He is trying to say, the beast is God. The dragon is God. The dragon, he calls down fire from heaven so that he can say, look, he's God. Only God can do this. Read your Old Testament, Jews. What did Elijah do? He called down fire on Mount Carmel after mocking the prophets of Baal. And so what does he do? He does it. And what do people do? They worship. Okay, stop running, please. They worship. And they make an image to the beast. Now, where have we seen images before? Daniel. Nebuchadnezzar establishes the multi-metallic image after having the dream about the interpreted dream about the multi-metallic image. Yeah, absolutely. The Israelites made a golden calf. You know, behold, Israel, these are your gods who brought you up out of Egypt. Okay, so this is all freighted with Old Testament imagery. And Revelation, I've said this before, Revelation is a book that rewards people who pay attention. Not just Revelation, but to other passages in the Bible. And Revelation is a book where if you think it sounds like something you've read, you're almost certainly right. This does sound like something you've read before. And so pay attention to your Old Testament. Pay attention to the rest of Revelation. It's all on purpose. Okay, so anybody else have any other comments? That's a pretty straightforward part. But do you guys, all right, verses 50, and was given to him, to give a spirit into the image of the beast, so that the image of the beast should speak and should make so that as many as should not worship the image of the beast should be killed. And he made all, the small and the great, and the rich and the poor, and the free and the slave, so that they should give a mark upon their right hands or upon their foreheads, so that someone should not be able to buy or to sell except the ones having the mark of the name of the beast or the number of his name. Okay, so the beast is given authority to make an image like the first beast, and the image is going to speak, and he's going to be able to, it seems like he's going to be able to kill anybody who won't worship the image. And everybody's going to have to get a mark of the beast. And if they don't get the mark of the beast, they can't buy or sell. And, man, what is that image? Now, some people have said it's TV. I'm not quite buying that. I'm not quite buying that it's a TV. I don't know what it is. I don't think it's a TV. What is this image of a beast? I don't know. If you guys have any thoughts, I would very happily hear it. But one thing I do know, here's what I do know. We have image, right? The image of the beast. We've seen the image of the beast, and it's referring, I think, at least back, Beard. And give you remember what happens in Genesis chapter 1? God makes man in his image. In the image of God, he created them. And what does he do? He breathes. I'm not saying that this was a new creation, that there was an image of the beast that was made out of clay, and then the false prophet did it, but I mean, there's a lot of supernatural stuff happening here. I'm not going to rule that out. I don't know what it means, but I think that it's a mockery of creation. I think that what we see with the image of the beast is clearly wanting us to reference Daniel and the world system and the world rulers who are going to be defeated by Christ. But putting a spirit in the image, does it mean that it actually looks like the? I don't know. Both are legitimate options in Greek. I don't know what this means, but I know that it's referring back to creation. And it's, again, a mockery of what God has done. It's an imitation, a poor, cheap imitation of what God has done. And again, everybody who doesn't worship the image is going to be killed. Everybody's going to have to get the mark. Wait a second, where have we seen the mark before? Well, you guys remember because we've talked about it a lot. The seals on the foreheads of the 144,000. It's a mockery. And then we get verse 18, which is, given rise to many books and many many frightening internet memes, right? So here is wisdom, the one having a mind, calculate the number of the beast, for it is the number of them. FYI, there's also a really important manuscript of Revelation that says it's 616. people have made a lot of what 616 is, or 666 is. Adrian Rogers, who I love, wonderful Bible teacher, says 6 is the number of a man, and therefore 666 is the number of the unholy trinity. Most people believe that it's numerology, that if you add up the name, because in Greek, Hebrew, and Latin, all the ancient languages, every letter corresponded to a number, and you could add up somebody's name, you could calculate the number of their name, and that would give you, and they're saying that the number of the beast's name is 666. That probably is the best answer. But that doesn't get you anywhere because there are lots of names that add up to 666. Depending on whether you're doing it in Greek or Hebrew or Latin, there are lots of names that work that way. So also if it's 616, also could it be that 666 happens to coincide with the numerical value of the person's name because it means the unholy trinity? Could be all those things. Could be none of them. Yeah, I think that's very possible. Yeah. So I think we're on the same wavelength there. I think it's something that I don't have the answer for. and if that means that I don't have wisdom, that's cool, because I'm okay not having wisdom here. I don't think lots of people have tried to twist this around to prove that Napoleon was the Antichrist or whoever. In fact, if Pierre Bezukhov out like the number of somebody's name, and it's funny. You can, if you want to read all like 2,000. Anyways, go ahead. Oh, yeah, that's an excellent. Yeah, that's an excellent point. I don't have anything to add to that because that's a really good point. I think there's, especially to a Jewish audience, they would have, the hand in the forehead would have stood out obviously as at least a possible reference to the Shema. The law of God was supposed to constantly be upon the head and the forehead and the hands. Why the forehead and the hands? What you do, what you think, you know. So there's this relationship between, you guys are in 4-H, right? So, you know, I pledge my head to clear thinking, my heart, health. I don't remember the pledge perfectly, but the head and the hands, right? Head and hands go together. And so it's symbolic in there, but it's symbolic here too. So does it mean that people have to get a physical stamp on their foreheads or their hands? I think it is, but just because it's literal doesn't mean that it doesn't also have symbolism associated with it. A flag is a literal thing, but there's symbolism associated with the flag. This is the problem. I'll go over one more minute, and I promise then I'll shut up. The problem with so much of liberal theology when they want to interpret portions of the New Testament are, is they say, well, this has clear symbolic value. Sure it does. That doesn't mean that it didn't actually happen, right? That Jesus being nailed to a tree has clear symbolic value. That doesn't mean that it didn't actually happen. So something being symbolic, lots of times we do things that are symbolic. You guys are all wearing wedding rings. Is the wedding ring a symbol? Yes. Is it also a real ring? Yes. So the fact that something has symbolic value does not negate its reality. So anyway, okay, so anyways, does anybody have any other thoughts before we wrap it up tonight? I mean, if we look just at what the text has, it appears that anybody who doesn't have the mark, anybody who is living, they're not going to be able to buy and sell. So you either better be like a Mormon who has several years of food stored up because they expect to be here during the tribulation, and I agree, they will, unless they repent and turn to the actual living God. So that's a possibility. But it's, I don't know. I guess long story short, I don't know other than to say they won't be able to buy and sell in any system that's actually controlled by the beast. I will make that caveat that when it says they won't be able to buy or sell, it doesn't mean nobody's going to buy or sell with them. There's going to probably almost certainly be a black market. I think what it implies is any nation that's allied with the beast or ruled with the beast, as far as their authority extends, they will control the markets there. And will there be a black market? Probably there will be. I don't think that this verse, but maybe it should be taken as brutally. They're gonna have any other questions? That's a great question. Any other thoughts? All right. Well, thank you guys so much for your time and all your patience and listening and good questions. Great. No. Oh, Mormons don't believe in the actual Jesus. Mormons believe that Jesus is a brother of Michael the Archangel. They also, God, so there's a well-known Mormon phrase that is, as man is, God once was, as God is, man shall be. They believe we will all, well, they believe in Jesus. I want to be really careful how I say this. They believe in a form of Jesus. They believe that Jesus died on the cross. They believe that the man, Jesus of Galilee, died on a cross and was raised from the dead. But they don't believe that his death was full for atonement. They also believe that you have to do works to go to heaven. That it's not just believing in Jesus. It's also you have to become a member of the LDS church. And they've got some other beliefs. But yeah, so Mormons have pretty universally by almost every Orthodox. It's close, but it's but yeah. And see, that's where, see, that's what's, I guess, I want to be careful how I say this, because I've known a lot of Mormons and I've witnessed to a lot of Mormons, and a lot of them, I believe, are very kind people who are trying very hard to be good and to do what's right. And I love, but with that caveat, I would say that Mormonism, in a lot of ways, Mormonism is really close to the truth. And a lot, and when you have, the problem is what you hear from Mormons, a lot of people go to the Mormon church because they rules that they have and they like how clean it is, but they don't act. So when you talk to a Mormon, it's always important to ask this, and this is my policy. Whenever I talk to a Mormon, I always ask them, is this what you believe, or is this coming, is this official LDS doctrine? They don't call themselves Mormons, they always say LDS. And that's an important question, because a lot of them don't know the difference. And you have to push them on that, and you say, is this what you believe, or is this LDS doctrine? And normally they'll say, okay, I'll come back to you, because a lot of times they don't know. But they have the doctrines and the covenants. They have the Pearl of Great Price. They have the Book of Mormon. And when they say that, like, that's part of their story. But a lot of them don't know more than that. So, and maybe the Mormons you knew were very well educated on their system. Yeah. 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 Yeah, no, a lot of it is. They have really toned that down over the years. Most Mormons, and actually James White has done a lot of good work on this, but they used to have, did they ever, okay, I when I was in the Air Force, I had some great Mormon friends. I don't want to bash them. I want them to come to the truth, and so I always agree with them as much as I possibly can, because there's a lot we agree on. The problem is there are some big things we can't agree on, but yeah, they're a lot of nice people. They've toned down a lot of their weirder beliefs. Like they have underwear. They believe that their special undergarment openly. Yeah, I mean, they don't talk about this. They've changed because their prophet, whenever something becomes unpopular, your prophet can always get a word from God. Like they did with Coca-Cola. A lot of people don't realize that Mormons, before they were not allowed to drink, you know, caffeine Coke, and lost a whole lot of money, and they sold, and then they came back out with Coke Classic and made a lot of money. And the Mormons, like, missed out on that. They missed the boat. So at least that's the story of it. But yeah, if you get a chance to witness, if young Mormons come to your house, the Mormon missionaries, invite them in and talk to them and try to at least give them something to. Have you had any? Okay, you know what though? It's a really fine line, because as long as the conversation is going, there's hope that things can move, that you can maybe move forwards. The problem is eventually you have to come to a point where you have to say something that might end the conversation, and that's the tough. Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's only the New World Translation. You can't read anything else. If you read anything other than the New World, it's bad, even though the New World is a laugh. Well, good night, guys. Thank you.